the Constitution didn't include, you know, I would say 90% of the people who were living in this country right now. For us to really try and interpret a late 18th century document in a strict fashion in the 21st century is ridiculous. Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week, while my co-host Maria Hinojosa is on a reporting trip in Nebraska. Joining me is Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. Welcome back, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining me is Christian Farias, Legal Affairs Reporter who covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the Huffington Post politics team. Hey, Christian.
Excited to be here, Julio.
So we're going to start like we always do by recapping some of the major stories of the past week. First off, Devin Nunes. And that's Nunes, not Nunez, Senator Chuck Schumer.
He needs to replace Chairman Nunez.
Nunez is the House Intelligence Committee chair who claimed this, according to unnamed sources.
I recently confirmed that on numerous occasions, the intelligence community incidentally collected information about U.S. citizens involved in the Trump transition.
So after that bombshell, right, the New York Times reported that both of Nunez's sources are Trump administration appointees. This does not look good. Christina.
Well, unfortunately, the widespread corruption in this particular administration is so deep-seated throughout so many members of Congress who are trying to make the Trump presidency legitimate and somewhat successful. And what they don't realize is when it gets hot in the kitchen, he will ditch all of them. So many of them are putting their own reputations and their careers on the line for someone who has never shown any loyalty or credibility in any sort of in any of his interactions. So the fact that Nunes, as a sitting member of Congress, who's going to get in front of his colleagues and the press and the American public and essentially try and defraud them and lie about information that he has to know is a sliver of the truth, if not a flat out falsehood, is really surprising. We haven't seen this level of audacity since either the Iran-Contra affair or the Nixon administration.
Christian, what do you got?
Let us not forget that all of this began with the president tweeting on a Saturday morning about suspicions that he had about President Obama spying on his transition team. And of course, that is a wild accusation. There is no proof of that that has been uncovered. And here you have a supposedly independent member of Congress trying to, some people say, carry water for him, trying to kind of cover the president's tracks because no credible source thus far, no credible investigator, no credible intelligence committee person or anywhere in the national security apparatus has been able to corroborate anything that the president has been tweeting or accusing the prior administration of. So just to kind of throw in a congressman now who heads a supposedly independent committee to try to, just make the president look good, it compromises what Congress is trying to do to try to get to the bottom if Russia did or not influence our election.
Not only was Trump tweeting in the morning, I think it was 7 a.m.,
something
right?
like that.
It was early.
He throws things out there that have no basis.
That he sees on TV.
Yeah. But what I was going to say, he throws things out there that he feels, right? Then Fox News picks it up. So then he sees it on TV. And then all of a sudden he says, well, the news reported it. So now I'm saying it.
And
so
it's got to be true.
It's got to be true.
Also, this past weekend, the Kentucky federal judge ruled that a case accusing President Trump of inciting violence at a March 2016 rally can proceed. So in case you don't remember, Trump was talking about protesters at his rally, and he said this.
All right, get him out. Get him out. Get him out. Get him out of here.
Yeah, I think he made it clear.
This has not gotten to court yet, but this is what the judge ruled, and this is the quote. And it said, it was an order, an instruction, a command. Trump's statement at least implicitly encouraged the use of violence or lawless action. Christian, do you think this is a turning point on some of Trump's more over-the-line rhetoric?
I don't think yet that it is a turning point. First of all, the lawsuit is very early on in the process. The judge only allowed it to proceed. I saw some blaring headlines over the weekend saying court rules that Trump incited violence. No, the court did not rule that. The court simply said, okay, there's enough allegations here where we can allow the protesters who were allegedly roughed up that they can proceed with their claims. It may go to trial at a later stage. But the second thing is what is notable here is that you have a federal judge ruling against a sitting president, mm-hmm. and it's allowing a lawsuit to proceed against a sitting president. And we're talking about a kind of things that are unprecedented about the Trump administration. This is one, because I don't think a judge would be emboldened to do such a thing if it was any other normal president. But here you have one who is so litigious in every respect, mm-hmm. who has said things and mentioned things. You have judges, not just in this particular case, but in the travel ban cases also, quoting from the president's words and saying, hey, look, this could potentially be a constitutional violation just because of what the president is saying.
Because he doesn't understand the role of the presidency. He doesn't understand the weight of his words. You know, so with Twitter, for instance, you know, he doesn't understand that, right. you know, he can make markets rise and fall, which he kind of likes doing, you know, almost this like yo-yo effect. Like, I can right. tweet your name and tank your stocks. But what the clip didn't show was Trump also said, you know, back in my day, people like that would be carried out in a stretcher.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
So let's move on to our main topic today. Neil Gorsuch, Trump's nomination to fill the open Supreme Court seat left by Antonin Scalia. Monday morning was the first hearing with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as we're taping this, news has just broken that the Democrats have enough votes to filibuster Gorsuch's nomination. But before we discuss the politics, I want to talk a little bit more about Gorsuch and his positions and his beliefs. This guy is a seriously conservative justice. I mean, just listen to this quote he gave about Scalia.
The great project of the justice's career was to remind us of the differences between judges and legislators.
When it comes to the Constitution, Gorsuch is an originalist. So Christian, what does that even mean? And why does that matter?
Originalism basically is a school of legal thought that believes that everything that is written in the Constitution, word for word, should be interpreted according to the way the founders intended it when they first ratified the Constitution. So if something was ratified in 1789, exactly what the founders thought of free speech or the Second Amendment or any right you can think of.
So give me an example that people can kind of latch on to that.
An easy one is the Second Amendment, for example.
Okay.
You know, they're saying that the Second Amendment protects a right to bear arms. But people might think, well, but didn't back then, didn't they have bayonets and all these old school guns? Does that mean that, you know, those are the guns that you're supposed to have? And the other side, the progressive side, it's kind of fighting it because they're saying, no, but the Constitution is a living document.
Right. A breathing document. You know, I mean, the Constitution didn't include, you know, I would say 90% of the people who were living in this country right now. Right. And so for us to really try and interpret a late 18th century document in a strict fashion in the 21st century is ridiculous. I mean, right. none of us on this conversation are included in any right. of those conversations.
And that's one thing Scalia loved to say. The Constitution is a dead document.
The Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living, but dead. Not what current society, much less the court, thinks it ought to mean, but what it meant when it was adopted.
The minute it was written, it died at that moment. It has no life of its own after.
Which, you know, and I disagree because I teach my students that it's a living, breathing document that moves and adapts with the time. And luckily for us, it has done so that women are included and people of color are included. And we've had some obvious, really negative setbacks, i.e. with policies versus immigration and internment camps.
And just like the whole slavery thing.
Yeah, that 400-year blip. But, you know, what are you going to do?
That little thing that, you know,
that got me here in the first place, right?
The Constitution originally did not include, did not protect African-Americans, did not protect slaves. The original Constitution counted a black person as 3/5 of a person. And so that goes to show the level of respect that some of our original citizens were given. But then, you know, we have the Reconstruction Amendments in the 1800s. You have the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, the 14th Amendment, which provided equal protection of the laws and due process of laws for everyone, and the 15th Amendment, which provided black citizens the right to vote. And all of a sudden, these amendments became part of the Constitution. This fixed the original sin of the Constitution. And by fixing it, it elevated everyone else who wasn't included, people of color, women, to that same status as white people. But the thing is, the problem that a lot of originalists have with this these amendments is that the 14th Amendment, for example, doesn't mention women, doesn't mention gender or anything. But the court later on, progressive courts have interpreted this equality guarantee to apply to everyone, you know. And so, you know, it's even though the Constitution itself doesn't mention women, courts, because they're wiser than many of us, they said, you know what, this document protects everyone, doesn't matter your gender. Even undocumented immigrants are included there, you know. So and that's something that originalism has trouble answering for.
It also, with Christian's example of guns, I mean, it brings in some really fascinating local, state and national arguments, right? Because New York City says, you know, we don't want your handguns here. It's 8.5 million people. You can't have a handgun. Like, the only people who are allowed to have handguns are police officers. Like, we are not an open carry city. We can't have 8.5 to 9 million people having guns. And I mean, as a college professor, we're having these conversations as well. There are lots of campuses now that are open carry campuses. I refuse to teach at an open carry campus. I mean, if you don't like the C- I gave you on your paper, are we going to settle this with not just a bayonet? I mean, these are, we have real guns now, like AK-47s, Uzis, where unfortunately American citizens can get their hands very easily on them. So the debate that they were having in 1789 is not the debate that we're having in 2017. So for someone like Gorsuch to say, oh, well, you know, guns are guns and we should just let people have it, it's like, we're not talking about hunting deer with your dad and your uncle anymore. We're actually talking about, you know, people who haven't been properly educated, people who haven't ever gotten proper mental health screening or mental health capacities that they need, that have serious trauma, even living in the United States. And we're saying, oh, yeah, give them guns because the Constitution says they could have it. That's ridiculous.
This debate between originalist philosophy and living constitutionalism, it's kind of the debate of our times. I mean, right now, the court is 4-4. It turns out that the four judges that were appointed by Democrats have a more liberal view of the Constitution. The four judges that were appointed by Republicans have this a more conservative view of the Constitution. They're not all originalist. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito don't call themselves originalists, and they don't use that language in their opinions, but they reach conservative results when it comes to individual rights, when it comes to criminal justice, when it comes to education, civil rights. This justice, even though it's only one vote, that one vote could mean the world for abortion rights. It could mean the world for, you know,
immigrants,
all these other things.
Marriage equity, you name it.
Right.
I'm just frustrated that we're even having this conversation because the Republican senators didn't even have the courtesy to even meet with Merrick Garland in their offices. So, I mean, they were willing to break down the whole system, right? The entire system in Barack Obama's last 1 year in office. But they're asking Democrats to sort of go along to get along to nominate someone who is, or to confirm someone who's more conservative than Scalia, just because it's the right thing to do because they're senators. But they never even gave their Democratic colleagues the same courtesy just 1 year ago.
A lot of people are putting a lot of effort into this nomination. They're hoping to see it through. They're hoping it succeeds because it'll give Trump the first true victory of his administration.
He needs a win. I mean, he needs a hit. Yeah. Seriously, right? Because travel ban 1, travel ban 2.0, Muslim ban, whatever you want to call it, like, both of those are failures.
Right. Although there's still an appeal, but you never know.
But I mean, as far as saying, I'm coming in day one, right? And I'm changing this, and I'm doing, it's like, no, you had to take one of the seven countries, you had to take Iraq off the list, right? Healthcare was a complete debacle, and he has unified government, which means he has Republican control of the House, Republican control of the Senate, and he's a Republican president, and he still couldn't get it passed because he doesn't understand Washington, D.C. He doesn't understand the Constitution, but more so, he doesn't respect Washington, D.C. or the Constitution. He's essentially been raised in captivity in New York for so long and just really punching below his weight. And so now he's in the big leagues and he's completely lost. So he needs this win, because if he can't get, when he has a majority Senate, and if he can't get Gorsuch through, that will look poorly. Yes, it'll look poorly on Republican senators, but and they'll try and blame Democrats, and Democrats will obviously just keep saying Merrick Garland, right? What's more important, though, and this is what bodes well for Gorsuch, is that there are external forces that have nothing to do with Trump that are way more invested in having Gorsuch on the bench, because they know once Trump is long gone, Gorsuch will be there well beyond Trump. And that's what they're invested in, really changing the whole composition of the country.
Hey, this is Noam, producer here at In the Thick, and we've got some cool news. In the Thick has been nominated for a Webby Award for Best Interview/Talk Show. We're super excited to be in such great company. So if you have a second, please go to inthefic.org and follow the link to vote for us in the Webbies. And tell your friends to vote too. And if you're a fan of In the Thick, try our sister podcast, Latino USA. This week, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. Listen as Latino USA sheds light on the forgotten history of Mexican repatriation and a mysterious arson of immigrant farm worker housing. Subscribe to Latino USA wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week while my co-host Maria Hinojosa is on a reporting trip in Nebraska. I'm joined by Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, and Cristian Farias, Legal Affairs Reporter for The Huffington Post. Let's get back to the conversation. Okay, so we heard how Gorsuch is an originalist and how he doesn't really see his role as one that is about making progress. And a lot of people are worried about what this might all mean for his opinion on civil rights. I mean, just listen to what Senator Dianne Feinstein said during Monday's hearing.
Senator Blumenthal asked the judge if he agreed with the results of Brown v. the Board of Education, one of the most important cases in our history, I think everyone would agree. Rather than agreeing that schools shouldn't be segregated, Judge Gorsuch instead said it was, quote, the correct application of precedent, end quote. To be clear, when he asked if he supported Brown, Judge Gorsuch refused to directly answer.
But on the other hand, it's not like Gorsuch is on some kind of crusade against civil rights. I mean, Christian, I remember the piece that you wrote in Latino Rebels in 2015, where he's, you know, he criticized an immigration lawyer and he's also defended undocumented immigrants and he's openly spoke out against overcriminalization.
Right.
Today, we have about 5,000 federal criminal statutes on the books, most of them added in the last few decades. And the spigot keeps pouring, with literally hundreds of new statutory crimes inked every single year.
There are many mischaracterizations about Gorsuch's record in terms of how he's ruled on things. The fact of the matter is, on a topic that is dear and near to Trump's heart, which is immigration, the judge actually might very well rule against him many times because Judge Gorsuch has a very kind of thing against the administrative state as a whole. So an immigration law is carried out by DOJ, is carried out by bureaucrats. And whenever bureaucrats are trying to do something to hurt somebody, whether it's a business, whether it's a person, you know, conservatives really care about that. And in this case, he happened to have ruled very favorably and even prevented the deportation of some immigrants. So, you know, there are times when, you know, he's painted as with this broad brush as this kind of ideologue. And it's true that he has had some decisions where it does appear that he has a really, really strict view of certain things. But
especially when it comes to business.
Yeah, when it comes to business. And when he also ruled in the lead up to the Hobby Lobby case, he ruled for the religious owners of the ability of religious owners to deny contraceptive coverage to their female workers. You know, so on issues like that, he has kind of revealed that he has a very kind of conservative view of things. But yeah, I mean, right now, the truth of the matter is, anything he may have done in the past 10 years as a judge is one thing. Mm-hmm. But once you get to the Supreme Court, you get cases that you don't see in Colorado, that you don't see in New York, that you don't see in Alaska. You see cases like affirmative action. You see cases like abortion. You see cases like campaign finance, who, you know, as much as we want to say that the Constitution has an answer for everything, there are many things where judges truly have to grasp at straws to try to find what is the right result based on the law or the little law that we have. And on those issues where things are really gray and unclear, he could be the defining vote because you only need 5 votes to change the law for the whole country. And right now they're 4-4 and he'll be the 5th one.
Definitely a big moment. And trust me, the Democrats understand this. I mentioned earlier that the Democrats now have enough votes for a filibuster. So Christina, do you think the Democrats are doing the right thing by taking a stand here?
I think they are. I mean, you know, Trump wouldn't be the first president to have a nominee go up, not pass, and he's going to have to come back to the table, maybe with someone who's a little less conservative. You know, Democrats are trying to finally act like big D Democrats, and I think a lot of them are really smarting over the fact that Merrick Garland never even got a conversation. I think some Democrats are really frustrated that Gorsuch hasn't even decided to come to some of their offices and answer some of their questions. But as Christian was saying, if this man could essentially be the deciding vote as to whether or not women get contraception or are allowed to have abortions, or whether or not they're going to repeal marriage equity, or, you know, whatever it may be as far as affirmative action or education or you name it. I mean, a host of right. issues that affect all of our day-to-day lives. This is something where no one is standing by the sidelines, and we need to be putting pressure on our elected officials to do what we think is the right thing, whatever it is that you think is the right thing.
I'm going to go audit your class.
Come on in.
Christian, what do you think about all the politics and the filibuster and the silly nuclear option description?
It's a silly description, but it's very real and very powerful. And the reality is that Democrats filibustering may seem like a big power play, and they're playing to their base and they're rallying their progressive supporters, but they're still in the minority in the Senate. That's the reality. And the filibuster may protect the right, but Republicans are still in power in the Senate. And Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate majority leader, he could say, hey, look, nice try, but we're going to drop a bomb in your little protest, and we're going to get rid of this filibuster, and we're going to confirm Gorsuch anyway. So enough with this 60 vote threshold thing that you guys are trying to pull off. And, you know, again, the Senate may never be the same. Things will be more partisan than ever afterward. Gorsuch will still get confirmed. And now Democrats will not have a filibuster. No one will have a filibuster because it won't be a thing in the Senate anymore. And then what happens?
I mean, Americans do prefer divided government, even when their quote unquote team is winning. Right. So in 2008, when Obama, you know, came in with the big groundswell, and, you know, we had Democratic House, Senate and presidency, and we saw how quickly that turned for a host of reasons in 2010. But if we look historically, all citizens actually prefer divided government, because even when they're getting what they want, they don't like the fact that it's so easy
right.
for one party to just sort of have wholesale agendas.
It forces you to work with the other side.
Yeah. Well, a lot of Americans think, well, yeah, I got what I wanted this time, but what if next time it's unified government against me? And that's actually not good.
All right, so let's move on to our final segment, Mic Drop. This is a segment where guests get to choose from a list of options for their final words. You say your piece, and then you drop the mic. So we got five options: Fantasy CNN, What's Missing, Tough Questions, Mea Culpa, and Side Eye. So, Christina, what option do you want?
A little bit of side eye to my senior senator, Chuck Schumer, who seems to want a lot of credit for going against this particular administration and saying that he's going to fight. But, you know, that's your job as the minority leader in the Senate. And you shouldn't want a cookie every time you say, you know, I'm going to go against someone who is wholly unqualified for the cabinet position. I think that, you know, he's ultimately on the right side of history, meaning the correct side, when it comes down to it. But I think it takes him a little bit too long to get there, especially as the minority leader. And I think he needs to be doing a lot more leading with all of the Democrats, but also some moderate Republicans, and giving them a reason why they should be caucusing with level-headed Democrats.
No cookies for you, Chuck.
No cookies.
Christian, what do you got?
Yeah, I'm with Christine. I'm going to give side-eye, perhaps not to Chuck Schumer in particular, but to Senate Democrats in general. Even though they've shown kind of a strong unified front on this Gorsuch fight, they have kind of peddled some kind of crazy ideas about this nominee. He is not the devil, as he's been painted. He is not, you know, against the little guy. As we said earlier, he has ruled for undocumented immigrants. You can't get more kind of empathetic than that. You know what I mean? If he were a demon, he would be ruling against them. He'd be saying, yeah, deport them all. But, you know, Judge Gorsuch hasn't done that. Don't paint him as something that he's not. But yes, you have every right to say, you know, the court is 4-4 and he's going to be a fifth vote for all these other issues that we care about. You can paint a big picture about the things that Americans care about, but just kind of making him into something that he's not, it kind of comes off as disingenuous.
All right, so I'm going to choose side eye again. I'm on this side eye kick, and here I go again. And it just broke Bloomberg talking about Susan Rice being the person who, quote unquote, is unmasking Trump associates in the Russia hearing. You know, this just happened hours after the whole Blackwater story got published by the Washington Post, saying that a Trump associate met in whatever that island is. I mean, it's just like when the Russia scandal broke and Trump immediately sends out the tweet, and all of a sudden you have all these like conservative like blogger journalists going Obama wiretapping, and now Susan Rice. So maybe it, you know, the Trump was right So instead of trying to dig deeper into those stories, it's just so convenient to provide Trump supporters this alternative universe and say like, oh no, look at this shiny object over here. And then people just kind of go there and it's like, oh, Susan Rice, red meat, blah, blah, blah. It's a constant pattern of what's going on in the media.
Oh, and P.S. Julio.
Yeah.
What's missing?
Yeah.
Trump's tax returns, all those other things. Those are a whole bunch of things that are still what's missing.
Oh, those little things.
Yeah.
Uno, dos, tres.
Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, and Christian Farias, Legal Affairs Reporter for The Huffington Post, thank you so much for joining me on In the Thick.
Thank you, Julio.
Thank you for having us in the hot seat.
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And remember, go to iTunes to rate and review us. It really helps. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and the other music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Record. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos. Thank you so much for joining me on In the Thick. You guys can say thank you.
Oh, thanks, Julio.